This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We've reached the end of the fossil fuel era, whether we like it or not, whether we voluntarily switch off the fossil fuels or whether we just wait till they become too expensive. Either way, you know, the game is up.
What will a post-carbon tomorrow look like? Most experts agree that the end of the age of cheap fossil fuels will mark a fundamental change in human history. The question that no one can answer, though, is how well will our species adapt to these new realities? This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, author Richard Heinberg, believes that a key to better understanding the current global economic slowdown lies in how we gauge progress itself. The author of 10 books, including Peak Everything and Blackout, Heinberg's latest book, The End of Growth, suggests that in order to thrive during this post-carbon transition, we need to realign our goals to promote human and environmental well-being rather than continuing to pursue the almighty dollar. In my conversation with this important thinker, Heinberg talks about the policies and conditions that need to be in place for our species to evolve in the face of ballooning population, dwindling resources, and global climate change. Next on Sea Change Radio, Richard Heinberg. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Richard Heinberg. He's an American author and educator, and his latest book is The End of Growth. Richard, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you, Alex.
First, why don't you state for our listeners what the general thesis is behind your book, The End of Growth?
Well, I wrote the book because I think it's pretty clear that we've reached a fundamental economic turning point. It's almost axiomatic that growth in consumption can't continue forever on a finite planet. And a lot of people have been talking about limits to growth for 4 decades now. But as a result of the recent financial crisis and also leveling off of world oil supplies, I think it's pretty fair now to open the discussion to whether we've reached the end of GDP growth as we've known it, certainly in the U.S., And what we need to do to adapt to that. The subtitle of the book is Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. So much of the book really is about what we can do in terms of policy and also in terms of household and community responses to rethink our economic path in the world so that it's realistic and it serves us in light of the fact that we've probably reached the end of this era of growth that stretches back for the last couple of centuries and certainly since World War II. We've gotten hooked on growth. We think that GDP growth is the measure of success. Every politician promises GDP growth, but the reality is there are limits to debt, limits to energy, limits to other natural resources, limits to nature's ability to absorb the wastes of the industrial processes we've put in motion. And the evidence, I think, is pretty clear that we're hitting all of those limits pretty much at the same time.
So your thesis is that the world has peaked not only in terms of oil, but economic growth, Richard. But are the two inextricably linked? Or if someone tomorrow invented cold fusion fuel, would you still think that growth is ending?
Well, the two are very strongly linked. I think limits to world oil supplies are one of the tightest constraints on economic growth, particularly for the U.S. It's not that we're running out of oil, but that we've finished off the cheap, easy stuff. And U.S. Has a history going back to the 1970s. Every time we see an oil price spike, we see an economic recession immediately afterward. So that happened in 2008. We had the biggest oil price spike in history, and of course, we had the biggest recession afterward. We're seeing very high oil prices now, and they're not likely to go down absent a total economic collapse, which would reduce oil demand. Every time the economy starts to recover, the price of oil goes back up, and that chokes off economic activity. So we're in a situation where sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Now, if somebody invented a magical new energy source tomorrow, would that make a lot of difference? Not over the short term, maybe over the course of several decades. But our energy infrastructure is very slow to evolve. We're basically using the same energy sources now that we were several decades ago. Some of our power plants are, you know, have been online for decades. The likelihood of a miraculous new energy source is pretty low, and again, even if one showed up tomorrow, it would be at least 20 or 30 years before it would make much of a difference. So, over the foreseeable future, I think economic growth is pretty much constrained by world oil supplies, and those constraints are hitting hard.
So do you view the end of growth in a optimistic light, or is this something, or is this a bad thing?
Well, it's both, you know. It's clearly the argument can be made that it's a bad thing because we depend on growth for so much. And if the economy stops growing, then suddenly a lot of bets go sour. That's what happened in 2008. Everyone is betting that economic growth will continue and even increase. Not only politicians, but economists, investors, people who sell real estate, all the way down the line. So if economic growth stops, as it's really basically done for the last 5 years, then a lot of people suffer. So it's not a good thing. But if you take a longer view, it's something that has to happen. I mean, if economic growth could continue forever and we could just continue increasing our consumption of all of Earth's resources, then we really would face a horrible situation, maybe a generation or so out, when there essentially wouldn't be any resources left and human beings would have chewed up and spit out the planet, and that would be it.
So how should individuals and politicians view that balance between trying to find the right mix between moving forward and progress and trying to conserve what we have on this planet?
Well, I think a key is going to be switching our economic indicators. For the last several decades, since World War II, we've used GDP as really our main measure of economic health. And GDP, gross domestic product, is essentially just the total amount of money we're spending in the economy on an annual basis. So, you know, if we're spending money on weapons or prisons, it makes the GDP go up, even though those things may not make our lives any richer or happier. If we cannot continue to increase our consumption, which I think is the case, then continuing to rely on GDP is very harmful, psychologically, culturally, economically, every other way, because we won't be able to grow GDP. Our aims will be frustrated and we'll be going in the wrong direction anyway. If instead we were to adopt a more robust indicator, gross national happiness, you could call it, and there are many people who are proposing that, or a genuine progress indicator, something that takes into account the integrity of the environment, the satisfaction of people with their lives, whether they're employed or unemployed, whether we're spending money on things that, like weapons and prisons, or spending money instead on infrastructure and things that people will actually be able to use for many decades to come. If we had an indicator like that, that would send us in a different trajectory, a different direction as a society. And we could have happier, more fulfilled lives, stronger communities, a better environment year after year after year without increasing consumption.
Hanging out with the street people, they got it down.
it down. Hanging out with the street people, drifting from town to town. To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is author and educator Richard Heinberg. Richard, can you expand a little bit on the Global Happiness Index? Let's say you're a CEO of a 30-person company. We've always been taught that the measure of success would be to grow that business.
Sure.
How do you go about trying to grow that business within the reality that you're setting forth in your book, The End of Growth?
Yeah, a post-growth economy. Sure. That's a fair question. I think of it as being analogous to an ecosystem. You know, all of Earth's ecosystems, just about, with a very few exceptions of deep ocean water ecosystems, but just about all ecosystems depend upon incoming sunlight. And the amount of sunlight that we're getting on an annual basis is pretty constant. And yet within that energy flux, there's constant evolution and adjustment and competition between species. Ecosystems change from year to year. They go through seasonal cycles. Some species flourish. Some species pass away. And I think our human ecosystem, our economic ecosystem, would evolve similarly in a steady state situation where the amount of energy and renewable resources that we were harvesting from nature were constant and based on what was actually sustainable and renewable. Under those circumstances, you know, some businesses would flourish as when people are smart, they come up with good ideas, they know how to serve people's needs better, then they would those businesses would grow. And other businesses that have, you know, run their course and no longer have cutting edge ideas, they would fall by the wayside just as they do now. But there would be a fundamental difference between that and what we have now. What we have now is an ecosystem, an economic ecosystem that requires constant growth in throughput. In other words, more energy and materials year after year, where we're depleting non-renewable resources and we're using renewable resources at rates that are greater than nature's ability to replenish them. That can't continue.
Richard, you write that we're counting on Moore's Law while setting the stage for Murphy's Law. Please explain that to our listeners.
Sure. Yeah, a lot of people look at what's been going on in the computer industry and communications industry, all of our handheld electronic devices over the last 20, 30 years, and they see amazing progress. You know, computer chips keep getting smaller, cell phones keep doing more and more cool things. And we have to understand that while there may be lots possible in terms of, you know, new software and iPhone apps, what we're facing with, let's say, a world agriculture is a very different situation, where the basic technologies we're using today are pretty much the same as we were using 50 years ago. The difference is we're running out of topsoil and fresh water and stable climate.
Getting back to the cold fusion discussion, let's just take it back to 1876 or whenever oil started really becoming the next big thing. This was, people didn't really see the downside yet in terms of the environment, and the resource curse was something unheard of at that point.
Right.
But it still took several decades for this new silver bullet, quote unquote, technology to take root on a global scale.
That's right. Yeah. You know, there are all sorts of things that people dream up as being possibilities in the future. I remember when I was a kid, it was nuclear energy. And the promise was that nuclear energy would be too cheap to meter. But here we are, you know, in 2011. And the reality that we're seeing is post-Fukushima, you know, nuclear power is actually on the decline worldwide, because we've seen that there are unintended consequences, there are costs. And this is something we've been reluctant to appreciate as a species. Every advance that we make in technology has a cost associated with it. We tend to ignore those costs in the early days of adoption of the technology, and it's only later on that they catch up with us. Now, we spent the 20th century adopting a lot of new technologies in transportation, agriculture, communication, and so on. And in the 21st century, we're starting to see the costs of all of that technological development begin to mount up. And that's one of the factors that's leading to, I think, the end of growth. And I think it's a moment when we should be sitting back and thinking, well, how much technology do we really need? To what degree does technology really make life better? And to what degree is it just making it more complicated and speeded up and making our lives more, you know, frustrated and unhappy?
Rather than looking at a worst case or best case scenario for a post-carbon world, can you share with us some individuals or technological innovations that make you feel that the future doesn't necessarily have to be so bleak?
Well, sure. I mean, when I think of adaptations leading us to a post-carbon society, I think more of social adaptations rather than new technologies. Yeah, sure, solar panels and wind turbines will help us get there. But things like the transition town movement, hundreds of towns around the world have these grassroots movements going on of people who are coming together to share food, share experience and skills to, you know, help their communities overcome their addiction to fossil fuels and to adapt to a post-growth economic paradigm. That to me is really hopeful. Or another thing, in towns around the U.S., we're starting to see the emergence of what I'm calling community economic laboratories. Typically, they have a different name in every town, but it's like, you know, every town has credit unions and job centers and local food organizations, farmers markets, and so on. But usually they're just kind of sporadic and disconnected and so on. But in lots of towns around the country, people who are into these alternative movements and organizations are starting to see the usefulness of linking up and sharing their facilities, sharing their knowledge and skills and so on. And the result is they become more visible within the community. There's more networking. There are more possibilities. When people find themselves out of work and needing help, they know where to go. When people have something to share, either skills or you know, spare garden produce or whatever, they know where to take those things to share them. To me, those developments, the social developments, are really what's hopeful.
People get ready, there's a train a coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. Thank the Lord.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is the author Richard Heinberg. Richard, you write about the shortcomings of efficiency, and you talk about how you and your wife have invested in solar panels and scooters and bikes, and you've really dedicated a lot of your time and resources into becoming more efficient. But you also mentioned how this is something that in a declining economy and people faced with declining incomes, this is not the kind of investment a lot of individuals can make. What kind of answers do you think there are for trying to make post-carbon world more accessible to people in lower income levels?
Yeah. The solar photovoltaics, the solar hot water, the rain barrels, the solar cookers, all the rest, you know, we've probably spent several tens of thousands of dollars over the last decade becoming energy efficient.
And unfortunately, so much of our infrastructure built from the suburbs back into the city has made it really easy to be inefficient and much less expensive to live in a unhealthy, inefficient manner.
Yeah, as people find themselves with less income and less household wealth, I think they're probably going to find ways to adapt that are cheaper than the ones that we've used. You know, a solar clothes dryer is basically a clothesline. and guess what? It's cheaper to use than an electric or a gas clothes dryer. A solar cooker is something you can make on your own, and it's cheaper to use than either an electric oven or a gas oven. Doubling up, you know, people, kids moving in with their parents. Well, this is a trend that's happening all across the country just because the kids, you know, can't find jobs. And it's not something that people plan ahead of time. It's not something that is being recommended as a way of conserving energy. But guess what? That's exactly what it does. As we find that we can't afford to run our own personal cars, you know, we can't afford the gasoline, we can't afford the insurance and car payments and so on, we find ourselves joining car co-ops or riding a bicycle more. These are conservation methods that I think will be more or less imposed by the economy. And, you know, we could adopt them in more or less intelligent ways. Something that I've been advocating for some time is sort of a new job category, which is the energy coach. If every community around the country had at least one of these folks who was available to, you know, kind of consult with families, households, and see, you know, how they're using energy now, how just a little insulation or joining a car share program, how much money as well as energy that could save them. I think a lot of folks could benefit from that.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Richard Heimberg. You talk about the disconnect between the climate change activists and peak oil evangelists and how they can work together. Where has the disconnect been, and where do you see room for improvement in this relationship?
Well, the disconnect, I think, has been that the climate change folks have been wanting to focus on the ethical imperative of getting off of fossil fuels, and the peak oil folks have instead focused on the economic inevitability of the end of fossil fuels. That, you know, there just aren't the resources to enable us to continue growing our consumption. In fact, I think that the two camps have mutually supportive arguments. The problem with the climate change argument has been that the business community looks at that ethical argument, we need to get off fossil fuels for the sake of other species and future generations, and they say, well, that's all well and good, it's a good ethical argument, but the fact is, you know, it doesn't serve our bottom line, and that's what's important. So for the sake of economic growth in the next quarter, we're willing to ignore future generations and other species and so on. The peak oil argument says, yeah, well, maybe you can do that for the next quarter, but not for much longer, because the resource just isn't there. For the sake of your own bottom line, you're going to have to switch off of fossil fuels anyway, so get used to it. I think together, the resource limits and the limits of the environment, those two arguments together are, as I say, mutually supportive, and they don't leave much wiggle room, in fact. We've reached the end of the fossil fuel era, whether we like it or not, whether we voluntarily switch off the fossil fuels or whether we just wait till they become too expensive and the supply becomes too intermittent to enable us to use them. Either way, you know, the game is up.
You write about in Blackout about peak coal. Why don't you share with our listeners how that relates to the China bubble?
Yeah, good. Yeah, because a lot of people will hear the idea of the end of growth and think, well, maybe in the U.S., but certainly not in China. China is still growing 10% per year. But of course, China has been growing on the basis of cheap coal. China is using 3.5 times as much coal as the U.S. is right now. And their economy is 70% dependent on coal. But as David Fridley and I wrote in Nature last November 18th issue, this is a significant burden on the Chinese economy because they're not going to be able to increase their coal supply much further. China's starting to import coal from other countries around the world, and the world supply of coal exports is pretty small, in fact. China burns about 3.5 billion tons of coal per year. The entire world export trade in coal is only about 650 or 700 million tons of coal per year. So China could absorb all of that with only a couple of years of growth in coal consumption. So this is going to be a hard limit on China's electricity supplies, and it's already being felt. There are electricity shortages in many cities across China. They're getting worse. And this is not something that's going to bite in, you know, 10 or 20 or 50 years. Almost certainly within this decade, we'll see China's economic growth come to an end, partly as a result of lack of cheap coal.
What are some of the answers for this huge economic beast that is going to just become hungry and hungrier and hungrier for resources like coal?
Yeah, the Chinese leadership is going to have to make some fundamental choices in the near future. What they've been doing is fending off those questions with the promise of more and more economic growth. As the pie grows, then the assumption is that everybody will benefit eventually, even though some people are getting filthy rich and most other people are still dirt poor. But as economic growth slows down in China, the social pressures of increasing economic inequality are going to grow. And so I think the Chinese leadership is going to have to come to terms with that. And that's going to mean more discussion about opening civil liberties, democracy, and finding ways of reducing the amount of economic inequality that's present in that society. If they don't do those things, then I think China will be headed in the same direction as a lot of the Middle Eastern and North African countries that have been seeing extreme social unrest over the past few months.
Richard Heimberg, his latest book is The End of Growth. Richard, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Thanks a lot.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Herbie Mann, Bobby Charles, and The Impressions.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.